Well, good evening, everybody. I'm Anthony Giddens, the director of the LSE. It's my great pleasure to welcome you all here to this lecture and discussion this evening, and especially to welcome two old friends and colleagues from Cambridge, Sydney Brenner, who is our lecturer this evening, and Marilyn Strathern, sitting down the front there. You'll get a crick in your neck if you sit there, Marilyn, who, together with Henrietta Moore, is going to be discussant for this talk. This lecture is the first public event marking the foundation of a new research program at the LSE BIOS, and I'd like to say, as director of the LSE, how strongly I support this program. Since I've been at the LSE, I've been trying to explore connections between the social and natural sciences in the belief that it's mutually beneficial to have a dialogue, because from the point of view of the social sciences, so many of the big changes affecting the world are driven by scientific and technological innovation. And from the point of the natural sciences, all scientific discoveries happen in a social context, have social and ethical consequences. We're building a fairly substantial program with Columbia University in the area of environment, ecological studies, and BIOS is a very good complement to that program. So I'd like to congratulate, to begin with, Nick Rose and all the others involved in BIOS on this initiative for the LSE. Let me now say just a few words about my long-standing colleague, Sydney, who I met many years ago when I think you were already at King's College when I first got there, and we were colleagues for a long time in King's College, Cambridge. Sydney Brenner was born in South Africa and educated at the University of Witwatersrand, Johannesburg, in medicine and science. He then went on to Oxford and received a degree of DPhil in 1952, working in the physical chemistry laboratory. After a brief return to South Africa, he joined the MRC unit in the Cavendish Laboratory in Cambridge in 1956, and I presume became a Fellow of King's at that time, or a little later. His early research was in molecular genetics. He discovered messenger RNA, which transmits information from DNA to proteins, with Jacob and Meselson, and with Francis Crick, showed that the code was composed of triplets. That discovery won him the prestigious Lasker Award in 1971 for basic medical research. Sydney won a second Lasker Award in 2001 for work in medical sciences, honoring his achievements over a lifetime. While Sydney retired from the Cambridge MRC lab in 1992, he came out of retirement in 1996 to take up the position of President and Director of Science in the Molecular Sciences Institute in Berkeley, California, stepping down from that position in 2001. Roger Brent, one of Sydney's colleagues at the Molecular Sciences Institute, captures Brenner's influence. This is a great quote, you need to listen to this. Sydney Brenner stands to molecular biology as Thomas Jefferson stands in relationship to the United States of America. Whatever that relationship happened to be. Sydney's decision to work on what he calls the worm had a profound influence on molecular biology. His research on C. elegans led the way toward the first genetic mapping of a multicellular organism, and contributed in significant ways to the development of the Human Genome Project. More than 3,000 scientists across the world are studying C. elegans as a model, and their collective work is contributing to new knowledge about the process of aging and the growth of cancer. In 2002, Sydney was awarded the Nobel Prize together with John Sulston and Robert Horvitz. In his acceptance speech, he mentioned that a woman came up to his wife on a bus and pointed out that someone with the same name as her husband had just won the Nobel Prize. This leads me to, I had this thing in my jokes file for about 5 years since I've been at the LSE. I never had a chance to read it out. I don't know if it's a familiar story to scientists, but I thought it's quite amusing. It's about another Nobel Prize winner. It's actually an obituary of a chemist called Donald Cram. Professor Donald Cram shared the 1987 Nobel Prize for Chemistry for his work on making molecules that mimic biological processes. After he was awarded the Nobel Prize, a representative of the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences made the congratulatory phone call at dawn, having looked up Cram in the telephone directory. Unfortunately, the man he spoke to was Donald Owen Cram, who ran a carpet cleaning company. Donald O. Cram told his wife that he had won the Nobel Prize. "That's nice," she said, and went back to sleep. 5 minutes later, the phone rang again, and Donald O. Cram asked the caller to describe the work that had won him the prize. "I do a good job on carpets," he said, "but this seems a little excessive." The title of Sidney's lecture tonight is Persons and Genomes, Genetics and the Human Sciences, as it shows up there. Sidney, I think, is going to talk for about half an hour or so, and then there'll be 5 minute interventions from our two panelists, and then we have some time for open discussion. I'm really grateful that Sidney's agreed to put on this performance here tonight, because he's going to Japan, he tells me, early in the morning. So it's indeed a noble gesture. So please give him a very warm LSE welcome here.
Well, I think it's a good time to start a project linking the social and the biological sciences, because I think we are about to see the birth of a new science which blends them all together, which we might call the human sciences. In fact, I think it might be a topic that every politician ought to be made to do, just to learn about humanity itself. The subject I'm going to deal with is a very complex one, and I thought I'd split it into three little sections. First, I've got to tell you about the technology, and so you've got an idea of what people can do. This is a field where almost every sentence begins with the words, "we will be able to." And you have to distinguish very carefully, as in this field, as indeed in all of life, between impotence and chastity. So it becomes very important when you're dealing with the ethics is to decide whether it can't or won't. Right, so this is the background then. So it all starts 50 years ago, 1953. Watson and Crick published a paper in which they showed the familiar icon of our times, the double helical structure of DNA. And for the first time, one could see a solution to major problems of biology, and especially major problems of genetics. And essentially, you could just see that we could begin to study the biochemistry of information, or the chemistry of information. Chemistry, of course, could also be called very low energy physics. And so for the first time, we could see that how we could have a physical analysis of information in biology, because as you know, biological systems are unique complex systems in the universe in that they carry an internal description of themselves in the form of their genes. No other complex system has this property. The weather is a complex system, but indeed you can't clone the weather, basically because there is no internal description lodged on a physical basis. So that was the first revolution, and very quickly we came to learn what genes were, what genes did, how the information was passed from the gene to the workhorses of the cell, which were the proteins. And we worked out a lot of this fundamental biochemistry in essentially a decade. Now, the next major revolution took place in the mid-70s and depended on two technical discoveries. One was a method of cloning DNA, that is, of taking DNA out of any organism, putting it into other pieces of DNA called vectors, and then propagating these pieces inside microorganisms. So that one could take the genome, that is all the genetic material of any organism, and create a library of fragments, and therefore you could gain access to the genome directly. The next important work was done by Fred Sanger, which was a method of directly analyzing the chemical structure of these pieces, namely DNA sequencing. And so you could imagine, as was imagined in 1985, that we could determine the entire structure of the human genome, which was quite a dramatic thing to do at the time, because the human genome contains 3,000 million base pairs, whereas the biggest genome that had been sequenced to that date was one of a bacterial virus and was about 50,000 base pairs. So the aim was to do something orders of magnitude larger. And as you know, that period culminated a few months ago, when the final, really final human genome sequence was declared finished, right? And now, of course, one has to ask oneself, what are the consequences of having all of this knowledge and all of this information, and also the technology of manipulating DNA? Now, the first impact of this on the public came in the mid-70s, when people discovered cloning and the fact that they could clone DNA and put it back and do what was called genetic manipulation or genetic modification. And so the question was this dangerous? And in fact, in my own personal history, I went doing a science which began as being called completely useless. In fact, Sir Ernest Chain, one of the inventors of penicillin, was very keen on getting all funding stopped for molecular biology in the UK on the grounds we hadn't cured anybody. But I pointed out to him that we also hadn't killed anybody, which couldn't be said. So we went from being totally useless to a science that was now dangerous. It was both useless and dangerous. And of course, there was a whole period which was very interesting, because it was the first kind of contact of scientists with ideas that were being propagated in the media and by various people, that this could be dangerous, could change the whole path of human evolution, and that we ought to stop it. And I participated a lot in the discussions at the time, and I learned a lot about what was called ethics at the time. But if you look very carefully at ethics, you'll see it really means politics. And I think that's quite important. And you will see that this theme is a very important one to tackle, because it involves something which we should all do properly, we should all do rationally. It's risk-benefit analysis. And I will give an example at the moment to show that we have no rational basis for doing this, and that in fact the most important person doing this, the man in the street, doesn't understand probability. And I'll come to that again, because this is very important. Now, The question has now arisen that there are now many social, legal, ethical, political consequences of this work, and that is, they pose certain risks. They pose a theory of how society should react, interact with scientists, and I think that's very important to study. And it also poses how scientists interact with society. And of course, scientists have been told to be socially responsible. Of course, I think society ought to be scientifically responsible as well. And those two things need to go together. So I thought I'd take three case studies, if you like. So one is GM food, which everybody knows about. That is, and we have to really start to analyze this. So as you know, it all began with the fact that what people do is to put genes from bacteria which have evolved and protect themselves by having a protein in it, so if they're eaten by mosquito larvae, which feed on them, the mosquitoes die. So it's their defense. This protein is a natural, if you like, insecticide. So the idea was, well, why don't we make this gene part of the plant, and then if the insects eat this, I give you just one way of genetic modification, then of course they will die, and of course we could cut down chemical insecticides which would then be this. Now the question is that this gene is put in a certain technology, and one of the things we use in order to do this is to couple it with a drug resistance marker. Right? And one of the objections to this thing is we now are eating plants that carry a drug resistance marker. In fact, that's one of the things that people opposed at the time. Now, there are all other kinds of genetic modification of food, which of course are always with the eye, carried out by companies who actually sell packages of DNA called seeds. So they're actually in the business of marketing DNA in natural little packages, and who can embellish these packages in various ways. And of course, this is done so that yields can be improved, and of course it has an economic benefit to the farmer. Now, is GM food harmful? There is no scientific case to say that it is harmful, because all of the cases described are scenario cases. And scenario thinking is the worst possible way of doing this, because there's no comparison. In other words, rather than arguing about where you are leveled in the tree, you should also know that, rather than arguing that you're off the ground in the tree, you should also know what level you are. And you need to have a comparison of what this is compared to other things. But the main consequence, in my opinion, of why this is been a very confused issue is the fact that scientists are very unwilling, unless they reach my age, to say that this is perfectly harmless. Because the scientists would say, well, of course, you know, there's a very low probability. When you say how low, he'll say very low, and won't give a number to it, because he wants to leave an opening for himself. When you reach my age, you're willing to make predictions which you realize could never be discovered the truth could never be discovered in the rest of your lifetime. And it doesn't matter if people curse you when you're dead. So I'm quite happy to say that it is completely harmless. Right? Now, but the most important thing that I think we need to take on is that people do make calculations about risk and benefit. Right? And when the benefit is zero, then of course, whatever risk it is, however tiny, the ratio is infinite, because any number divided by zero gives you infinity. Right? So when there is no benefit to the recipient. So the scenario, or at least, here's an example of something which I would have done had I been in charge of this. I'd have not only labeled the food, I'd have charged more for it. And I'd have put up a sign saying, this extra money that you, the people in Britain, are paying for, will go into a fund into which the company will put its patents and will use this to develop tropical agriculture. Because at least there would be a benefit of charity, which I think is a perceivable benefit, and people would have been prepared to pay more for it. At least that's a speculation that I think we ought to consider. Because in all the other things, when they involve medicine, ordinary people can perceive there's an ultimate benefit because they know medical science has brought benefits. But eating square tomatoes is very difficult to understand how that could be beneficial. So, and of course, it lands up in the ludicrous equation, that in a country like Zambia, it was thought to be less risky to have famine in the country than meet the consequences of eating GM food. In other words, food was rejected in Zambia because it was GM food. Now, that's an equation which I think is very hard to put together. And I think it gives you one of the examples how we must try to achieve some kind of rational way of doing the rest of the risk-benefit equation. All right, now that's one where I think the public, and I think this extends to a lot of things, and I'll come on to the next one, which is the whole area of what's called predictive, probabilistic, or personalized medicine. It's believed that part of human disease is, we all know that when we look around us, humans are very diverse. There is the person who eats enormously, never gets fat, never has heart disease, and there are always the people who claim they eat nothing and still grow, and then become susceptible for disease. And the idea is that there are certain genes that make you susceptible. This is not it's not an unreasonable postulate, because our genes were those of the people that survived the last ice age, and we've still got them. And of course, when you have a long winter, then the big thing to do in summer is to eat as much as you can and store up the food so you can survive the winter. But of course, today winter never comes. And so people continue to eat. And looking at, let us say, the group of American Indians living in Arizona and looking at pictures of them at the beginning of the century, of lithe sort of people, and looking at them now, because irrigation destroyed their economy, they all live on welfare, everything they eat is deep fried, they all weigh in excess of 250, 300 pounds, And there's a 50% incidence of type 2 diabetes amongst these people. And this is a consequence of having a genome which survived life up to about 1912. And of course now there's a very different circumstance that they find themselves in. So the idea has been propagated in various forms that there will be genes that predispose you, and that therefore we will be able to find these. I'm not saying that people have found them, but this is the theory. And therefore, this information will be able to say something about you. And of course, immediately there's the problem of who should have access to that information about me. And of course, it's most important for health insurance in countries like the United States, because the argument goes, if you can look at the genome and predict that these people are going to be susceptible to heart disease, then they will be either not get insurance or get insurance at a higher price, because insurance companies want to win all the time. Okay, so what are we going to do about this? Are we going to secure this evidence as private? What do we have to do to ensure that it remains private and that doesn't become part so that you become genetically discriminated against? Of course, there has been a whole class of our society that have been genetically discriminated against on the grounds they have two copies of one chromosome, the X chromosome, called women. But of course, now we're going to have various classes of genetic discrimination. And what are the consequences of this? So I would like to just, and of course everybody now wants to know, are we going to have legislation to preserve privacy on this matter, or what are we going to do? And I would just like to analyze this situation from, I think, an important point of view. This kind of susceptibility is only probabilistic. In other words, I can't say for certain. It's very different from, let us say, a late developing disease like Huntington's disease. We can say for certain you will get it, but we can't predict whether you'll get it at 40 or 50. But you'll get it, because that's for certain. This is probabilistic. In other words, you stand a higher chance of getting this disease. So let us just look at this from the point of view of the individual patient, because this is where we come to treat this as a simple case of practical medical ethics, if I can call it that. So, if you tell a patient, for example, if you take my treatment, you'll have a 60% chance of being cured, he immediately asks you, doctor, am I in the 60% group or the 40% group? So the idea of probability means nothing to the individual. I think that's very important. You cannot say for certain. Probability only has a meaning for social institutions, government departments, insurance company. In other words, they don't care who actually dies of heart disease, as long as it's only 40%, let us say. But they're actually not interested in the details. Right? That's probabilistic. So the individual doesn't understand probability. It has no meaning for him. On the other hand, he understands gambling. So if you come to him and say, look, I've looked at your genome, and I can tell you the likelihood is that at age 60 you will die of a cardiac disease, but if you stop watching television, eat properly, give up McDonald's, go through all these remedial therapies, that chance will fall from 90% to 5%. So he understands the odds are better. But you must be able to offer something for the individual, something that he, after all, it's his body, he's responsible, but you've been able to give him advice that is constructive. That is, it's no use telling a person that congratulations, in 20 years' time, you have a 60% chance of being a schizophrenic. And what can he do about it? He can do nothing one way or the other. There's nothing we can offer him. On the other hand, for some diseases, there is something we can offer him. So therefore, I say, we should do this when it's in the interests of the patient, and only when it's in the interests of the patient. The rest is research. But I mean, in fact, of individual genomes, we should only do that when it's in the interest of the patient. And I think that's very important. Otherwise, there's no point in making a map of this, because there's no point in telling him information that he has nothing to act on. So that's a point of view that I hold to very strongly. Now, people say, well, what's the difference between my taking a blood pressure and my looking at your genes? There's no difference, it's just another test. There is a difference. The difference is the following. When you take a blood pressure, that's about you now. Okay? If your blood pressure is normal, nothing they can do about it. But what we're talking about is someone who's normal, nothing's wrong with him, but he's got genes which foretell his future. It's like his horoscope, basically. In fact, I sometimes call it the genoscope. And should we allow insurance companies access to the futures of people? I think it's perfectly fair. They take a history. History is about your past. It's also about your parents. It tells you something about the genes. And I think it's fair that they can examine you to say something about you now. But access to the future, I think, is completely different. And they're not entitled to it. It's an extra kind of margin to them. And I think that that's a very important difference between a genetic test and a test of a person as he is there. Right? So I think that those issues now don't have to be embroiled in very complicated things about what you can call grand ethics, but they simply involve what I think are reasonable things, in my opinion, about how to deal with them in terms of the medical relationship. Now, another very common thing that we hear about is cloning, or let's put it under a much more general head, is alternative modes of reproduction. Right, so there is a whole hoo-ha about should people be allowed to clone themselves. Now, I think the best thing is that people are not very clear what these clones are, and it's best evidenced by a true story in which I was asked at a lecture by someone in the audience who said, why can't I clone myself and keep the copies of spare parts? And my answer was, be careful, one of the copies might keep you for spare parts. You see? So that is the first time I suddenly realized that people see these clones not as individual persons. They are just objects. Sorry. They are just objects which you sort of hang in a wardrobe, and every time you need another leg, you come and cut a piece off and graft it on. I mean, I've exaggerated, of course. So the point is that when you make a clone of yourself, it's actually your twin brother or sister. the case may be, but about a generation or more younger than you, growing up in a completely different environment, it's not a copy of you. So I think we ought to really distinguish very carefully, because actually we do quite a lot of cloning of persons already. We do it in institutions called armies, schools. We try to make everybody a standard, a standard issue. And in terms of doing that, we don't have to worry about the bodies. When I sometimes look at the soldiers, I think once they've cloned the minds, the bodies follow. And they all do look alike, actually. So I think that we need to distinguish very carefully between genomes and bodies on the one hand, and persons, because you are something more than your body. You are your memories. In fact, when we look at identical twins, their immunology is different. They don't have the same immune systems. They've been through two completely different pathways of exposure, and your immune system represents the results, so to speak, of your interaction with your environment from the point of view of foreign agents. They're completely different. And of course, your memories are completely different. So I think we ought to be very careful about distinguishing in that case between persons and genomes and bodies. Now, of course, the whole discussion now, which is revolving around cloning and what is called therapeutic cloning and the whole of the stem cell issue, is the following. It is argued that if we could get stem cells, we could do something that's called regenerative medicine. We could actually repair you. If you have damaged neurons, as in Parkinson's disease, we could replace them with good ones again. The point is that because each individual has an immunological identity in terms that we well know that you can't transplant tissues freely between different people because they reject foreign tissues. So, the argument is if we just took any old stem cells and put them into you, it would have no effect because you would reject them as foreign. So we have to make stem cells that you don't reject as foreign. Well, one way of doing this is to clone yourself up to a point where we can make stem cells from this, and then you'd have a customized stem cell that would be okay for the individual. Now, of course, to clone you, we have to actually get a fertilized egg and substitute one of the nuclei from your somatic tissues into this egg, and then we would have, when that developed further, it would carry all your genes and hence have all the properties determined by your genes and would be compatible. Because we don't know yet how to drive your cells backwards in time. Okay? And such experiments have been done. Dolly the sheep is a famous one, but wasn't very successful. So this is not a very clear-cut technology, and certainly given what the regulating authorities do, it certainly wouldn't be advised to do medically at all. So I'd like to finish off by just saying we can discuss all these matters within this, but I think we ought to look now at a much wider area, both in time and place. If you were to ask what is the main ethical imperative, if you like, for a bioscientist who's working in this field, I think we owe a responsibility towards the whole of humanity. And I think that becomes very important, this identification with all humanity. Because at the end of the day, when we look at what human ills there are in the world, the ones which we have in Southern California are quite different from the ones that we'll have in Africa, for example. As you know, the SARS epidemic involved, I think at the end of the day, less people than died of malaria in 3 days. That is, something like 3,000 people die of malaria each day. So, and of course, as all of you know, the HIV epidemic in Africa will result in 45 million deaths. There's no doubt about it. Okay? And that has already resulted in the huge changes in life expectancy, which are absolutely horrific. And you might have argued that that's one of the topics that medical science ought to try and do something about. But we all know that the way healthcare is delivered in our societies is through institutions, of which the most prominent are the pharmaceutical companies. And since pharmaceutical companies operate for profit, then of course people in Africa have another disease called money deficiency disease, and therefore it's not worthwhile. They're trying to produce cures for people who can't pay for them. Now that says there's something wrong when you take the broader principle that we owe a responsibility towards all of humanity. But it's led me to actually think that everything we have presaged in the field of medicine assumes that the actual system won't change. And I think this would be a very exciting thing to look into. Given all these changes, given the fact that, as I once said, what we should do is to tell people that you have leased your body from the human germline, and of course if you don't look after it, we're going to come and take it away from you and give it to someone else. Now of course we can't do that, but we could change the person inside your body to be someone else who takes responsibility for it. And I do think that just to speculate, let us say, a quarter of a century down the line, it could be that pharmaceutical companies, everything is presaged that with this relationship with the public, that you can do what you like, and then when you get ill, they'll be there with a pill to save you, which you can take at home. That's the whole industry is based on that relationship. Well, it's quite conceivable to me that that's no longer tenable, may not be tenable in a different kind of healthcare system. And so it may well be that pharmaceutical companies could well become extinct. At least they are now becoming like the dinosaurs, getting larger and larger, and perhaps when there's one pharmaceutical company left in the world, it may actually find it's got nothing to do. Because you realize that pharmaceutical companies cannot deliver stem cells, just like they can't deliver cardiac transplants. They've got to be delivered through completely different social institutions. And I think it would be worthwhile examining the economics and of a society in which the current theories of health change markedly over the next 25, 30 years, which is quite conceivable. We read today of an epidemic of obesity in the developed world. Well, you know, there's a very simple surgical way of treating obesity, which is just to stitch up people's mouths so they can't eat. But there must be other ways of doing it rather than trying to discover a reducing pill which they could take at home and pay immense amounts for. We also read today that drug resistance has just advanced in microorganisms, bacteria, so that the last drug that we could use, vancomycin against staphylococcus, is no longer effective. The bugs are resistant to this. So, and that is something that we've learned that we have done by interfering not by genetic engineering, but by environmental engineering, by feeding large amounts of antibiotics to animals. And of course, not realizing that bacteria still undergo evolution, and that natural selection is an enormously potent force. And we are left now with a major problem. So I'd like to think that all of this knowledge would result in something which we might call the new public health. I think if you look at the public health legislation of the 19th century, it was the most important step in advancing human health of all time, much more than discoveries of antibiotics. All you had to do was separate the water you drink from the water you excrete in. And that improved human health amazingly. So perhaps we should think of, is there a new public health? Is a new public health which would need new economic and social relationships within the societies as we know them? Well, I think that's your job to start thinking about. Thank you very much.
Could I just say before our commentators get on stage, this is my last 3 months at the LSE, and this is a chance for me to pay tribute, as it were, to the first program that really connected up the social and natural sciences in the LSE, which is Darwin program. And the Darwin program existed before I got here, and I hope, Helena, it's going to exist after I've left as well, because it was a pioneering endeavor, and I would like it to link to these other emerging programs as they develop. I was going to say which order we're going to go, but we're going to go with Marilyn by the look of it. So, please.
All right. So it's the natural order. Okay, Director Dr. Brenner. That was an enormously stimulating address. In fact, your talk has been something of a prism. And if I could reassure you, a very potent one. And of course, the point about prisms is that angles are set off from one another. One catches the light from different angles. And that, I think, is how I also imagine the whole venture which is set out in front of us. I'm delighted to be witnessing the launch of BIOS. It promises to bring together elements that are indeed often set off from one another. But does so with a challenge. And here I want to pick up just one aspect of the lecture we've just heard, because as you've made so evident, the challenge is not just how one understands science, but how one understands society. Now, Dr. Brenner's given us a glimpse into some of the issues that lie ahead in the unfolding of the science that defines, as it were, the genetics century. Not only have quite extraordinary advances been made in the knowledge of life systems, but molecular biology has revolutionized numerous human institutions, run through them like a virus or a meme. so that we have bioscience, we have biomedicine, biotechnology, bios in the plural. But if you turn the prism, then a different angle comes into view. For along with all that has gone another unusual characteristic of the genetic century, which is the reinvention of society as a legitimating endpoint. Because bios is also bios, that is, the finial in this phrase is society. Now, the talk we've just heard has been shot through with an appreciation of how developments in science, in technology, in medicine have consequences for society, and indeed, if I could add, ought to. I mean, I think something that you've put in our path, as it were, is the imperative for society to exploit some of the potentials that are there. But if you turn the prism to another angle, in fact, of course, you will see society already in the grip of biopower. And if we can take a leaf out of one of the associates of the centre, we can also think of bios as short for biosociality, or more pertinently, in the hands of Professor Rose. And this was a joke that you foresaw. Biosociality is, of course, also biopolitics, and everything that concept says about the biologized state that we live in. That is, we live in a regime, and I'm quoting Nicholas Rose again, whose intellectual technology comes from the new knowledge that we have about ourselves as humans. And it's knowledge of the new genetics that is regarded as a kind of prime social capital. We begin defining ourselves in new ways. Certainly there's a changing sense of citizenship. And one obvious example is the notion of informed consent. Only decisions made on the basis of knowledge can authorize the clinician or the researcher to go ahead. And we're so used to knowledge being a legitimator that we might, as it were, might stand back from time to time and just think about what we're constructing there. Certainly, informed consent is the thin end of another wedge in society's remoulding by science, the burgeoning of bioethics as a field of inquiry. And of course, bioethics is ethics with a very specific content, those developments in science, medicine, and technology we've been hearing about. And it's so pervasive that in this particular case, one doesn't have to spell it out. Bioethics isn't in the title of bios, because bios itself is an instantiation of bioethics. It's part of the phenomenon which it's addressing, an emergent social form, perhaps we could say. But that last realization gives us a new refraction. From philosophers with a leavening of social scientists, as one finds in so many forums, to this one, bios will be social scientists with a leavening of philosophers, and one begins to realize the importance of social science itself. Not just because social scientists are interested in any change or development in society, but because there's one very important question that only they can probably ask, and I had actually written down, which only they can answer, but you, sir, have already upstaged me, and as you'll see in a moment, you've actually already answered my question. Let me explain the context. The new readiness of science to see society and society's reactions in asking about the implications of various developments, setting up ethics committees and all the rest of it, is an example of what has been called the new social contract between, as it were, science and society, in which society starts talking back to the purveyors of knowledge. And the argument goes, of course, that science needs that interest, that their credibility these days has a new dimension. It's not sufficient to look to the lab or the journal or the peer review. Another kind of scientific credibility has also come to depend on public reactions, that is, on reactions assigned to a public. And that isn't just a matter of science teaching society. Public understanding of science programs have metamorphosed into science and society programs. And part of the new legitimacy of science rests on its ability to address social issues. The result is not simply a reliable science, but a socially robust science. So what is the question? It's a question, in fact, that Nicholas Rose asked years ago in another context. The question is, what then does social mean? Of course, one asks the question to make social or society vanish. But that vanishing is a kind of perpetual motion. Society is always just about to disappear. So what is fascinating about the present moment is to witness its reinvention. When we talk about science, we turn to the social as some kind of arena where the problems and possibilities it generates acquire a different form, as in the phrase, it's for society to decide. And a major preoccupation, as you're all aware, of research councils at the moment in identifying the kind of strategic steps they need to deliver an acceptable science is indeed to see the public as stakeholders and to take the public on board very much as players in the programmes. So the question is, what is the society that's being imagined here? If science must be socially robust in order to survive, what makes socially a legitimating epithet? That is, what do we need to know about society to make it work as a reference point for science? More generally, how do we produce knowledge of society that is scientifically robust? And this is where I echo one of your own phrases in which you talked about society being scientifically responsible. What kind of information do we need to know about social conditions in order to produce an account of social conditions that will be acceptable as an account of social conditions? What will qualify as an adequate description? In short, what will count as a description of society as an agent of sorts, not just there on the receiving end, but already caught up in a sort of co-evolutionary fashion with science? And these questions are, to say the least, a challenge to the social scientific imagination, but that I feel we can leave to grow in good hands.
Now we have Henrietta Moore.
It's a very brief introduction, wasn't
it? Well known to everyone at the LSE.
Well, I wanted to take up a theme again about the relationship between science and society, or if you like, between the social sciences and the biological sciences, which is, after all, what BIOS is all about. One of the problems we have in that relationship is in the idea that science is the senior partner, that is, in a sense, science produces something which equates in one way or another with prediction. Now the question of is, as Professor Spasern has just asked, is what kind of robust knowledge can we produce on the side of the social sciences? Now an interesting debate has just taken place in the United Kingdom because the Secretary of State for Education made the mistake of saying that universities were not about the unfettered pursuit of truth and excellence. He didn't, of course, tell us what they were about, but he said they weren't about that. Now, this, of course, raises particular kinds of problems for the LSE, because in a sense, the LSE takes the view that what it does is all about understanding the causes and effects of change. In a sense, the LSE is committed to a kind of public scholarship, that is, to the use of research to inform debates among citizens, advocates, and policy makers. So we have never, in a sense, been about, and nor will we ever be, the unfettered pursuit of truth and excellence. Now, setting it in that perspective, of course, if we look at what have been the major drivers of social and economic change over the last 15 years, we might agree that it has been indeed information technology and communication technology of all kinds. What seems likely is that in the next 30 years, the major drivers of social, economic, and political change, or at least one of them, will be developments in the biological and life sciences. And we know this is the case because we know, for example, that the pressure is on for multinationals and corporations to make money out of those developments. We know that many governments in the world are gearing up to predict economic growth and productivity based on those developments. We know also that other governments are worrying as Dr. Brenner said, about risk and regulation, the problem of how the state will respond not only to multinationals exploiting that information, but also, and perhaps more importantly, to its citizens resisting the implementation of certain kinds of policies. We know also, as Professor Strathern has just said, the biological and life sciences make a difference not just in relations between citizens, but in the case of understanding the identity of citizens themselves, everything from the way we think about ourselves to the way we think about our relationship to the world is in a degree under question here. The problem is, though, when we try to predict it, we are left with the minor problem of futurology. It is, as Dr. Brenner said, not in fact the case that most people are resistant to cloning. My own personal favorite story about cloning, before I heard this one about body parts, was the person who said that they really wanted to be cloned because they didn't like working very much. So what they planned to do was to make a clone of themselves who would go to the office and do all the work, and they would stay at home and rest. The minor problem of only having one salary between these two individuals was not addressed at the time. And of course, we've all heard the stories about how it would be possible to be the world's best athlete by going in for implanting genes to change muscle function, and various kinds of stories about a terrifying future. But I think if we want to think critically here at the LSE about that future, then we could do no worse than start thinking from the point of view of how social inequality will shape and will be shaped by developments in the biological and life sciences. Dr. Brenner began with the question of GM foods. As you know, the EU has declared a 5-year moratorium on GM. This has already cost US corn farmers since the late 1990s about $1.2 billion in lost markets, and it will cost them more. US corn farmers then, of course, became terribly interested in supplying what was called food aid to Africa, because food aid for Africa is helping the United States to sort out the problem of subsidizing its corn farmers. When Zambia and other African nations declared last autumn that they would not receive this food aid because they felt that it was genetically modified, the Americans were, of course, very annoyed, and they blamed the Europeans. The situation is much more complicated. Africa, particularly South Africa, is already involved in the production of genetically modified crops. Those genetic modifications are helping farmers deal with the 30% crop rate every year caused by weeds and pests and diseases. The only problem now is that they cannot and will not be able to, in forthcoming years, export their GM crops to Europe. So if they go in for GM, they will lose the European markets. If they do not, they will be uncompetitive anyway and possibly unable to feed themselves. That is the kind of complexity of the situation which the LSE needs to address. The problem about science and society, however, is that the relationship between science and society is one of our own making. Science, after all, in all its forms, is part of a human project to know, understand, and control the world. The question is science, though, driving the changes that we are striving so hard to control and to understand? Well, let's look at the question of technological innovation. What drives technological innovation? In my view, science and technology do not, in and of themselves, produce social change. Science and technology are always shaped and redirected by social factors, so that those who warn of or dream of fantastical, nightmarish, technologized futures where machines run the world are not in the world. They are simply not taking social factors into account. Society and technology work in some kind of very complex co-evolution. If we develop new technologies, like, for example, railroads, electricity, and computers, then we deliver and develop new social forms, new kinds of organization, new formal and informal institutions to manage the worlds of our own making. Pundits constantly predict that science and technology will either produce nirvana or Armageddon, and time again, they are proved wrong. It's certainly true that technologies such as the printing press and gunpowder and the internet have shaped societies in very profound ways. But it's also the case that governments and courts and professional networks and social movements and local communities shape and redirect that technology in ways that are not easy to predict. Now, if you look back at what happened with technological innovation, if you look at the 19th and 20th centuries, there technological innovation produced unprecedented advances. It also caused a great deal of social disruption. But that disruption, that dislocation itself went on to produce unprecedented degrees of social innovation, in innovation in the areas of government, in legislation, and in business. So that human societies respond to science and technological change with social critique and with organizational and institutional creativity. They also respond, of course, by resisting and denying these forces of change to a certain extent, by refusing to have their values and ways of life altered. Now, recently, there was an inquiry in the House of Lords into science and technology. And one of the things that the inquiry asked was, should public opinion influence the agenda of publicly funded science? And in the United Kingdom, the answer to that question was a resounding no. The answer was, well, science needs to know about public attitudes because, you know, public attitudes are a bit of a problem. They are a brake on development. And also, the public needs to realize that science is already well regulated and is regulating itself. What's interesting about that no is that when the same question was asked of the Netherlands Genomics Initiative, the answer was, well, perhaps what we should be doing is getting involved in research which is aimed at developing and promoting new forms of social participation in the development of genomics. What I'd like to conclude by saying is that when we are looking at the relationship between science and society, we are not just looking at the impact of science on society. It's not a one-way street. What we're interested in, I suppose, is how society will itself drive change, how it will drive science, and by driving science, it'll open up new possibilities and new challenges for science. And this form of analysis, this way of looking at scientific prediction as an outcome of social change is, of course, in my view, the proper work of the social sciences. Thank you.
I'll tell you a story about technology. When the Americans first went into space, they found that they couldn't get a ballpoint pen to write in conditions of weightlessness, so they spent $50 million producing one that did. In the meantime, the Russians used a pencil. We now have about a quarter of an hour for questions. There are roving mics upstairs and downstairs, so I invite comments or questions. Maybe those asking questions would like to say who they are and, if they wish, why they're interested in these issues. Shall we start with you, sir? Would you take the mic, though, because otherwise people upstairs can't.
All right. Just a very ignorant question about, you talked about the genome as information. Now, I just wondered, is it actually information? Our genes, do they, my impression, and again, this is extreme ignorance, is it more like a set of chemical switches that start off, well, okay, that's the question. But that you don't have to know what a gene means, you have to know what it does, what it sets off. So that's the question. Are they really information?
These are genetically modified flowers, so we had to take them away.
Do you want to store up two or three?
I think the questions could be asked to any of the three panelists.
Well, I'll just store them up, and if I can remember the information, I'll answer.
Yeah. Do we have another question then? Please.
You mentioned the difference between...
Do you want to say who you are?
My name is Katya Tugendsam. I'm a graduate student at the philosophy department. You mentioned the difference between nature and nurture, and that's an argument that we hear a lot from people who are against the technology, or for the technology, that say, well, we already have these institutions like schools and armies, and we shape and try to perfect people there already, so why don't we do this also? And I just haven't been able to, I sense there's a profound difference between shaping a person once the person is alive and before you actually get born. I haven't been able to wrap my head around what the difference is, so I'm asking the panel what your take is.
Thank you. One more?
Okay, one more. Then
we'll take one from up stairs. We need you to speak pretty well into the mic, if you would.
Okay, I'm Helen Wallace from GWatch UK. I'm pleased that you didn't want the insurance companies to have access to genetic test results, but I want to question a bit more the underlying health strategy of testing people for genetic susceptibility to common diseases. If the increase in obesity we're seeing at the moment is really to do with eating more and unhealthy foods, surely public health strategies like banning health advertising to children are likely to be more successful than targeting interventions at those genetically susceptible to obesity. And the latter strategy is probably more likely to end up with people taking pills for obesity rather than tackling the underlying problem. Would you like to comment on that?
Yeah, well, the last part, I totally agree with you that I think more will be done by coming to understand the interactions of the genotype and the environment. And I'm only just took an example. You could do much more for obesity by shutting all, by just not giving McDonald's an FDA license, for example. So I think you could do that. But I agree with you on that. Now, the other two questions, one was a technical question about information. I think that it's not information in the technical sense. There is an information theory. One would rather call them messages. So if you like, what is embodied in your genome is all the messages that you need to build the body that goes. Of course, we don't understand how that is done. And that is still a huge challenge, a huge scientific challenge that we still have to unravel. Everybody thinks that because we've sequenced the human genome, it's all over. But, and as you all know, the sequencing the human genome has been compared to putting a man on the moon. And that's the exact comparison, because when you think about it, putting a man on the moon's easy. It's getting him back, which is the difficult and expensive thing. And I think the human genome is essentially out there on the moon. Now we've got to get it back and find out how it works. So I think that's going to be a very long job. So I think it is that, but what I think in terms of how one looks at the science of biology, which of course has always been covered in mystic ideas of vital essences, and that is really different from the rest of the world, that until the recent changes, they were interested only in what you could call matter and energy. How do you make the chemicals that you find in biological systems, and where do we get the energy to do this? But the concept that, in fact, that information or messages could be embodied in chemical materials, that's new. And that's the big revolution in thinking about this. And of course, it is related in some way to, you know, the information technology revolution, if only by metaphor. So I think those two things, and now one hears of much talk of computational biology, but of course we still don't know what that means. But that's another question. Now, the business of nature and nurture, is, I think, quite simple. You see, what people are debating is, are we going to modify people by giving them genes? Now, of course, you see, I think it's best to think is, how would you know what genes to give them? So, you know, there is a story which says one day they will sequence the chimpanzee genome, and of course, what they look into it, they'll find there's an extra gene in the human, and that's the gene for language. Okay, that's the concept, okay? And we'll call it the Chomsky gene. But you see, there is an alternative hypothesis, which is chimpanzees have learned that talking gets you into trouble. And so they have evolved a language suppressor gene. Okay? And of course, they'll have the extra one. And we'll call it the Chomsky gene, but quite apart from that. But you see, language, of course, itself might be a very complicated thing involving hundreds and thousands of genes, of different genes, when you think of the voice box. I mean, I needn't go into it. But there's always one way of stopping it. You could stop it in a singular manner. All right? So that is the way you think of. So to have a not language gene makes sense. To have a language gene doesn't make sense. In other words, if you like, life is polygenic, death is monogenic. And there are different ways of dying, but it's always a singularity. Okay, so that's the answer to that question. Now, I'll just leave you with one extra thought. My good colleague, Jim Watson, who has now believes that he's the only one in favor of genetically modifying people, was heard to make the remark that the Irish are in need of genetic improvement. Of course, he quickly added that he was half Irish himself. But I thought about that remark, you know, and I really think that the improvement of people, biological evolution is obsolete technology. When you think of what humanity has achieved by cultural evolution, social evolution, I mean, to try and do this by fiddling around with genes is like, you know, reinventing the sled, not even the wheel. And what I think is this, that basically I've come to the conclusion that the brain is mightier than the genome. We should forget about all of those things and concentrate. If we want to improve people, there are the methods that in this different sphere of doing it, which are really effective and terrific. And for the other thing, we don't know what they're doing. I'll just add one other thing. Peter Medawa wrote in one of his articles that what he would have liked to have been was president of the Royal Society and at the same time the rider of the winner of the Grand National. And it leads you to contemplate whether you could in fact define a genome which could accomplish both those ends. I mean, maybe they're mutually contradictory. Maybe if you become president of the Royal Society, you couldn't even get on a horse.
Well, you can get a job at the LSE with these comments. They're very good for the social sciences, really. But we have a lot of people who want to ask questions. We don't have that much time left. Can I come to you in the middle? I'm sorry, I don't think we'll have time for everybody. I was going to take the lady there, but maybe we'll just pass it along to you straight away after that.
Eve Middleton-Kelly, the director of the LSE Complexity Research Programme. I was delighted to hear both the speakers and both discussants mention coevolution and emergent social forms. And what I would like to ask all three of you, please, is to reflect what would facilitate and what would inhibit the dialogue that might help that coevolutionary process.
Do you want to take the mic, sir?
My comment goes back to...
Would you like to say who you are?
Sorry, I'm Mark Walcott. I'm the director of the Wellcome Trust. I think there's a slight danger of a polarization between people who worry about genes and people who worry about the environment. And of course, the danger of the obesity example is that it's jolly easy to blame McDonald's, actually. But there are lots of other examples where it isn't quite so easy. In the case of many cancers, we don't actually know what the environment is. Okay, cigarettes was another example where the guilt was very obvious. In the case of many infectious diseases, we don't know. And therefore, in answer to Helen Wallace, I think it's just as important to know about the genes as it is to know about the environment. And we actually may only find out about the environment if we know about the genes.
Q, please.
Tracy Brown's sense about science. Can I first point out that those are actually GM carnations, as indeed more than 90% of carnations...
Do you want to maybe stand up?
More than 90% of carnations in this country are GM, so they are probably GM. The thing I was wanting to ask about is the elision that's kind of going on in this discussion about cost-benefit analysis between pure research and scientific applications when they reach society. Because I really wonder, Sydney Brenner, if in the 1950s you had had to make the case for the work that you were doing in terms of in the future for infertile couples, for example, and the birth of Louise Brown, or if you would have to make it in the case of the Green Revolution, and so on. Those are things that people just weren't imagining in the 50s. And I just really wonder whether some of that discussion might not be constraining our imagination about what the applications may be in the future. We may become a little bit too ultra-pragmatic about the kind of research that's engaged upon by talking about it's either its applicability, its social acceptability, its commerciability in the immediate term.
Yeah, I think I'd like to make a remark about the last speaker, and perhaps the other two could address the complex lady over there. I think you've hit upon something which I think is very important, because the whole structure of science and its funding has become so that in fact it's working against innovation. In other words, everybody, whether it's science that's being done under the peer review system, everybody wants everything to work. Everybody wants to know. Everybody wants a result. If it's commercial, of course, they need that even more strikingly. So that means that everybody has to say what the result is going to be and what's its importance and so on. And the best thing to do, if you can do this, is not to take a chance. I gave a talk in America the other day in which I said that everybody in funding research should set aside 1% of their money into what I call the casino fund, okay, and write it off on the day they set it aside, right? And the casino fund should be handed to successful gamblers who would know how to pick other gamblers. And it doesn't matter if they lose most of it. But of course, everybody who was quite content to have a mediocre result for the 99% wanted to get their yield from this. So there is a very, very difficulty now of doing really innovatory work in the current atmosphere of knowing the consequences of all your work. Now, I think one of the things is I think the scientists have actually asked for it. And so what we have now is a distinction made between pure and applied, but the one I particularly dislike is the distinction made between curiosity-driven research and mission-oriented research. Now, I think the moment you use the word curiosity with politicians, they insert the word idle in front of it, you see? And the main thing is this. Science is nothing else but a means of solving problems. It's the best way we know of solving problems. I mean, we've had 500 years of experience. We know that magic doesn't work. We know religion is unreliable. But science works, and I think that we should just forget all this distinction between pure and applied. It is the methodology of tackling a problem and finding a solution. And that's what I think scientists are engaged upon. and not just following curiosity, which I think is not the motive. The motive of all real science is the solution of problems, and that's the truth at whatever level, whether it's physics, biology, or whether it's in the social arena. And it doesn't also mean that you must use an experimental method. You must find the solution to the problem.
Should we just have two more quick questions? And then we have to wrap up, I'm afraid. Just you down there. I do apologize for those who we won't be able to get to. But you can speak for everyone, maybe in the audience, with a thrusting question.
Okay, I'm Carl, first year medic in Imperial College. Right.
Not to the audience, sure. For the audience. There is a difference.
Right, I just want to follow up the question about the social inequalities. What happens if those fancy technologies like genetic modification is held by the rich who is already holding these social resources, use that to enhance the gap between the poor and the rich? What happens in the consequences of this? And is there a way we can prevent this to happen?
Thank you. One more question? Can I take that? Thank you. Apologies to other people.
Hello, I'm Ruth McLennan. I was artist in residence at the LSE, and I've just produced a work for the Wellcome Trust.
Can you just speak up a bit?
Yes. I wanted to come back to this idea. You said, Sydney Brenner, about how scientists owe a debt to the whole of humanity.
Sure.
And it's really this relationship between... well, basically, what I want to ask is, what do you think the impact, and this is to everybody, what do you think the impact of increased imperialism is going to be on the development of the life sciences? The fact that certain international organizations aren't being taken seriously by the United States and that they want to bypass the international organizations. And what effect do you think this is going to have on, not just on GM, but on the development of all the life sciences?
Well, what I'm going to do, if you don't mind, is ask Sydney to respond to these two, and then ask our two commentators very quickly to wrap up after you've responded.
Well, I have no solution to that problem, but all I say is that if as a working scientist, I am asked to, you know, put priorities on different kinds of research, then I think we must take it as part of our ethos that we speak for all of humanity, never mind if there's only people speaking for a certain subsection of the world or even a certain subsection of part of the world. So I think that is, if you like, something that I think becomes important, and we should always draw attention to the fact that, you know, that the problem does not just confine, you know, the incidence of a certain disease amongst a certain group of people, but effectively what humanity is. But I think that I can't solve the question you've asked, and I can't even predict the basis for it, because biological science has been driven by the sciences of health. There's no doubt about it. All the rest is quite by the side. And I think that there is this passion for healthcare, especially in the advancing things. I mean, I call it ITHT, immortality through high technology. That, I think, is, if you like, what drives this entire program of actually, you know, treating all of these diseases. Now, these diseases have huge social impact. And we have to ask whether the present drive is the correct one to follow. At least I think scientists can say what they would themselves say what are the research priorities.
Marin, do you want to comment just briefly?
Oh, yes, I'll be very brief. I think I ought to respond to the complexity question, but I wanted to do so by bringing us back to the socialization question, which was very, very interesting. It was... just to remind you, parents all the time try to mold their children in their own likeness and so forth, and what is so new about the new situation? Well, of course parents do. They strive terribly hard because they know they're not going to achieve it. And I think one of the important things about the ideals we have and the notions of perfectibility is that we do it against the knowledge that you're not going to get there. And in fact, of course, socialization practices are built against the building up at the same time of the individual as the recalcitrant entity that is going to resist socialization. The two things sort of work together. And some of the fear, I think, behind the new technologies, which you've actually dissipated in bringing us back to all the uncertainties, is that thankfully we're not going to realize those orders of perfection. It would be very dangerous if we did. Which makes me reflect, of course, on the language of sort of co-evolution and dialogue, because, of course, dialogue's a metaphor. And the notion that there could ever actually be a resolution of these two entities is a fantasy, because the entities are also a fantasy. And I think that talking of new social forms is not to be prescriptive, it's to be open to possibilities of thinking about complexities of relationships and so forth that we can't necessarily see. But it would be, I think, quite dangerous to imagine that there could be a conversation that had an ending.
Well, I just wanted to say very briefly that technology doesn't cause social inequality. We cause social inequality, right? It doesn't make any difference what you do about genetic modification. If you already have the existing balance of power between Africa, the EU, and the United States, that balance of power will be used and exploited by various forces. That's why I think it is so incredibly important to look at the social side of this equation. And I think you really have to ask yourself morally, one of the big moral questions at the moment is all the amount of money that's going into looking, for example, at genetic modification which might be related to cancers, is that the way you want to spend your money if your other alternative is a vaccine for malaria, right? If you want to ask yourself which way will you prefer to do this? And actually, those kinds of moral decisions are very rarely presented to us in that form, because they're seen as zero-sum games. But if they were presented to us in that way, we're then left with the kind of problem we were left with small children, which is, do you eat everything on your plate because you know that children in Africa are dying of starvation? Right? It becomes an impossible kind of moral dilemma for us to deal with. But I think the issue is that we have to, in a sense, struggle with it. And the only way you can struggle with it is through a process of kind of intellectual critical reflection, which is the underpinning of the social sciences.
Well, or abandon the common agricultural policy would be a good first step, actually. Can I just say, I don't think you could have got a better event, actually, to kick off BIOS. I'm just going to ask Nick Rose to come on the stage, conclude the event, say a couple of brief words about the programme, thank our main speaker, thank our commentators, and thank me for supporting him.
Thank you, Tony.
I was taking notes as our speakers were talking and as our questioners were questioning, thinking that I would come up with some synopsis at the end, but I'm not going to. All I can say is that our three speakers today and our chair have identified very clearly at least part of the enormous agenda that the BIOS Centre at the LSE is going to set for itself. There's one whole area of our concerns that hasn't really been touched on, or only just in an aside by Dr. Brenner, which concerns issues of the neurosciences and mental health, which is also key to our agenda, but that would take another couple of hours. So before thanking everybody, just one word, really. My mentor, whose name I won't mention, was fond of saying that medicine was the first social science. And as Dr. Brenner pointed out, the early developments of medicine in the 19th century were absolutely fundamental to shaping the kinds of societies we lived in, both in the West and in the colonies. And vice versa, the kind of drivers in society were absolutely central to shaping the kinds of knowledge of health and illness and biology that we ended up with. So there is a kind of co-evolution there. And to some extent, the distinction that we suffer today between the biological sciences and the social sciences is a relatively recent invention, an invention across the 20th century, an invention, I regret to say, partly as a consequence of the disciplinization of knowledge within the universities and the professionalization of knowledge within learned societies.
I think the time is ripe to question that division and to think what might be involved in creating a social science that had a genuine understanding of biological and medical conditions and vice versa, when it wasn't a question of the implications of the one for the other or the implications of the other for the one, where social scientists weren't coming along after and always discussing what the implications of the sciences were, but involved in shaping their agenda. In particular, in asking, well, if we're concerned about questions of global health, what ought to be the drivers of our agenda of research, as a number of our speakers have said today? And remember, I believe it was Langdon Winner talking about the bridges and built over a highway in some American city who wrote a paper called Artifacts Have Ethics. Well, I think artifacts have politics, and I think knowledge has politics, and I think these biological knowledges have politics ingrained within them, ingrained within every piece of research, ingrained within every result of research. And those are the kinds of questions which our speakers have raised today and which I hope will go some way towards injecting into the intellectual agenda of the LSE. So to conclude, I'd like in reverse order, first of all, to thank Tony Giddens, the director of the LSE, for taking time in his very busy last few months at the school to chair this session, and also in being a tremendous supporter of this whole initiative from the moment that I came to the LSE, and I know from beforehand, and saying and in a sense legitimating that as a key issue within the social sciences.
He had to say that because he wants still more money from us.
Yes, you're going to give us a leaving bequest, aren't you, Tony? I'd like to thank Professor Henrietta Moore, who is one of the deputy directors of the LSE, particularly responsible for research strategy in the LSE, who's also been an indefatigable supporter of this initiative, both intellectually and practically, and we wouldn't be here tonight if it wasn't for Henrietta's efforts on our behalf. So thank you very much, Henrietta. Marilyn Strathern, Dame Marilyn Strathern, the Master of Girton College, or Mistress, are you? I can't remember, Marilyn. As well as her status as one of the leading anthropologists and indeed social scientists of the new life sciences, who's made really tremendous contributions to our understanding and the conceptual tools that we might use to understand these issues, is also now heavily involved in the practical concerns which are raised in the Nuffield Council for Bioethics, for example. And I think we are pleased and very grateful, Marilyn, for you sparing the time to come and launch our centre and saying such nice things about it. So thank you, too. And finally, well, there's very little I can say, really, apart from to thank Dr. Brenner, who is one of the Thomas Jeffersons of molecular biology, as Roger Brent would put it. And although we might not quite know what that might mean, we do know what it implies. He's done an enormous amount to shape the field. He's done an enormous amount to make it possible to have the kind of genomic knowledge that we have now. He's made an enormous contribution to our knowledge, not just of basic genetics, but of the implications of that for health and illness and aging. And as we see now, he is someone who's persistently across his career been concerned about the relationship between genomics and the human sciences. He started off by saying that the biological sciences plus the social sciences ought to equal the human sciences. And that, I think, is a worthy challenge to leave us with. If we can do anything to measure up to that challenge, then I think we will be very fortunate. So thank you very much, Dr. Brenner, for sparing time to come and talk.